this is a presentation workshop brought to you by the National Network of Prevention Training Centers. I hope that most of you are familiar with the network, but we did want to give you a brief overview. This is a national network. It consists of 18 regional training centers funded by CDC. And each PTC or training center, prevention training center, is a sort of a unique structure in terms of a partnership between a health department and a university. So it provides an infrastructure for one of our main missions, which is translating research into practice and facilitating that transfer by having both a research academic university component as well as a public health program practice component. We also, of course, address STD, HIV clinical, behavioral and partner services, including providing training, but also meeting technical assistance needs for the participants for whom we provide the training. Here's where we're located, and on the left, on the bottom, you'll see our website for more specific information about each of the training centers, but obviously we're pretty well distributed throughout the U.S. The clinical training centers, or we call them Part 1 PTCs, there are 10, and there are one in each federal region. So both are located in each DHHS federal region. The focus of the training for the Part 1s would be mainly on enhancing clinical skills in the diagnosis and treatment of sexually transmitted diseases. People learn state-of-the-art STD diagnostics, new tests, new treatment modalities, new strategies for patient management. Obviously, we're emphasizing recent advances in STD treatment and prevention, and more recently focusing more on STD-HIV integration issues, such as diagnosis and treatment management of co-infected patients with both HIV and another STD. Between 2000 and 2006, over 23,000 hours of clinical training were provided to more than 70,000 STD-HIV clinical providers. The behavioral training centers have been around about 11 years. There are four, one in each quadrant, which is the same as the Part 3, the Partner Services Training Centers, that we'll look at next. The focus of the training for the Behavioral Part 2 Prevention Training Centers is on STD and HIV prevention, and increasingly on an integrated approach to STD and HIV prevention. So the Part 2s provide training in evidence-based, research-proven STD-HIV behavioral intervention. Some of you may know as DEBIs. DEBI means Diffusion of Effective Behavioral Interventions, and it's a CDC-funded national dissemination program. The PTCs, the Part 2s, provide training that increases program capacity, the agency capacity, to do program evaluation, to do a community needs assessment, to select the right evidence-based intervention for a given community or population. And also, the goal is to improve the prevention practices at the community level. So the Part 2 is trained clinical providers and also providers who work in community-based organizations and community-level HIV prevention interventions. Partner services would be considered the Part 3s. And of the Part 2 and Part 3 PTCs, of which there are four, the West is served by California. In terms of Part 2 and 3, the South and Southeast by Texas, the Central area by Colorado, and the East Northeast by New York State. So that's the geographic location of the Part 2 and 3 centers. The Part 3s focus on effective interviewing techniques, effective counseling skills, partner elicitation skills, developing critical thinking skills to support case management, increasingly an emphasis for those who do partner counseling services. And then also enhancing program capacity to address changes and emerging trends in STD disease trends. So we offer courses that are different in some ways from other training centers in that we have a combination of sort of didactic training techniques as well as experiential. And the didactic, you know, focus on knowledge transfer and more traditional techniques. Most are more unidirectional. We use a variety of modalities for didactic, which would include in-person lectures as well as small group activities, large group activities. We are increasingly using online STD cases for didactic and experiential, and you'll hear more about that a little bit later. And we use, of course, traditional lectures, slides, videos, readings, reference lists, and demonstrations. The experiential training is focused on skills building, and so we do heavily emphasize that we want participants to leave with enhanced skills, not just knowing more about a particular topic. So these experiential techniques are bidirectional and, you know, show one, do one, and then sometimes teach one in terms of the sequence of how we try to build the skills. The delivery modalities can be in person, again, using one-on-one or small group, hands-on with patients, seeing patients in STD clinics with preceptors, providing immediate and direct feedback and coaching, as well as online using interactive case studies. Other examples would be for the Part 1 intensive courses, the STD intensive, for example, which may range from 3 to 5 days and includes possibly a day of lecture didactic and then 2 days or 3 days spent in an STD clinic with a preceptor. There are laboratory courses that are skills-based and experiential, and then we have the interactive web-based case studies that you'll hear about in a few minutes. The Part 2s offer experiential training in the community, for example. So you may learn and actually go out into a community setting and practice performing a needs assessment in a given community in some of the Part 2 experiential training courses, or participate in a group level intervention for STD HIV prevention. So that's just an overview. And again, please feel free to reference the website. And next we have Laura Bachman, who is the medical director for Alabama North Carolina STD HIV PTC.
Excuse me. Thank you for coming today. And I'm going to focus on the examination skills courses that are offered through the National Network of Prevention Training Centers. Before we get to the actual exam, one of the important aspects of the patient interaction is taking a complete STD and HIV history. And so we do focus on that interaction, teaching people which questions to ask, the most effective ways to ask these questions so that you get the most accurate information, and learning how to transition from progressively more sensitive topics more comfortably. This is accomplished through practice. I think most of us are not born knowing how to talk about issues of sexuality comfortably, especially here in the United States. And so it simply just takes practice getting used to asking these questions, and the more comfortable the provider is, the more accurate the information is extracted from the patient. So we practice through a variety of methods. It could be, depending on the training center, through role-playing. We may videotape the participant interacting with a surrogate patient, and then always giving feedback. Also, we may have this interaction in the actual clinic setting as well. In addition to asking about sexual activities, we also emphasize through the trainings behavioral risk assessment. And that means not only the specific risk behaviors that are practiced, but the contextual issues. For instance, as you can see from the dog there in the corner, he has had a little bit too much, tied on a few. So his decision-making capabilities may not be at their best at the moment. And then in addition to that, he's smoking on top of a newspaper. So many of the choices that we make in life, as everybody in this room knows, can affect you. And so we train people in also understanding the contextual issues, the venues at which these activities take place, the substances used, et cetera, and how they all interact. Once again, practicing this with role-playing interviewing techniques and also videotaping risk assessment techniques with feedback. There are an array of skills-based courses available through the training centers. One of these, as an example, would be venipuncture. During this course, one would learn the techniques of venipuncture, practicing on models, and then taking that practice out into the clinic, and all the time receiving preceptor mentoring and feedback. Also, STD exam skills, of course, are the core of what we do with the NNPTC. And as one of our breakout groups will show you later, this may involve, for instance, practicing first on pelvic trainers. Our other training centers may have surrogate models where you get feedback directly about how you're proceeding with the exam, even if that includes a kick in the head, hopefully not, if we're doing things right. But you can get live feedback sometimes. And then once you've practice, then taking it out into the clinic, And we have a variety of different experiences that are tailored to the beginner and also the more experienced clinician. A big part of this is having that preceptor there to watch what you're doing, to help coach you through difficult situations, and to give you that feedback. Also, we emphasize STD specimen collection skills, emphasizing the, first of all, in your history, figuring out where you need to take your specimens from, which orifices, et cetera, but also the proper way in which to take these specimens so that you get accurate results. And these are skills that can also be practiced on the pelvic trainers, the surrogate models, and then in the clinic. Finally, we also train people on the clinical laboratory skills, and Linda Cregan's going to get into this in more detail, but in particular in the STD clinic setting, we have STAT laboratories oftentimes, depending on, I think all the training centers have these, and then you would have the chance to observe the application of diagnostic tests with the rapid results and the way that it kind of guides the decision-making process. And this would also include the HIV rapid testing that we do training on. So with that, Linda's going to go into more specifics about the laboratory procedure courses.
Thank you, Laura. And I don't think I introduced myself in the beginning. My name is Linda Cregan, and I'm with the California Prevention Training Center. We're based in Oakland, and I'm going to be talking a little bit about our laboratory procedure courses. These courses provide you with very practical skills that you can use every day when you're seeing your patients for their STD care. And I'm going to ask, how many of you consider yourselves fairly new to the world of STD care? At least a few of you there. How many of you know that your clinic has started using some sort of a new test within the past year or so? So these are two instances that would be perfect for you to look into one of these courses that I'm going to be talking about now, where you can beef up your diagnostic skills, learn something new, perfect your skills, work on getting it to the place that you really would like your diagnostic skills to be. And when you enroll in one of our courses, there's, a variety of types of lab courses that you can take. Some of these courses emphasize the core diagnostic tests that are used in STD specialty clinics, such as syphilis tests, including the rapid RPR test and the dark field microscopy, as well as Gram stain techniques and saline and pale wet mount techniques. And we have courses that teach about the newer rapid point of care tests for STDs and HIV as well. Let's look first at those core tests for the STD specialty clinics. How many of you work in an STD specialty clinic? A lot of you. Not most of them. Great. Okay. So you know that the serologic tests for syphilis are very important. The rapid RPR test gives you results in about 20 minutes that can help you as you evaluate your patients who may have symptoms of primary or secondary syphilis, or these patients who are contacts to infectious syphilis. Getting the results quickly like that can help you to make an immediate diagnosis, get your patient treated, and then begin those partner management activities so that you can help to stop the further spread of that infection. In these courses, you learn to perform and to interpret both qualitative and quantitative RPR tests. And in one of the breakouts this afternoon, Pat Jennings will be demonstrating the rapid RPR in the context of a syphilis case discussion. That may be something that you'll want to practice this afternoon. A very important test for the diagnosis of primary syphilis uses a dark field microscope. And the dark field microscope allows us to take some material from an ulcer that we think may be a primary chancre of syphilis and to visualize, actually see, those treponemes that are the causative organisms of syphilis, treponema pallidum. In these classes, you would learn how to obtain the specimen correctly, how to use the dark field microscope. It is a little tricky. And then how to identify those T. pallidum organisms by their typical morphology and motility. And it really does take some training and some experience, some practice, to be able to identify T. pallidum. It's a very thin organism, as you probably know, too thin to even be seen using a light microscope, which is why we need to use this special microscope called a dark field. And it's by looking for organisms that display this typical morphology, a very thin, rigid, coiled spirochete. It's not a wiggly kind of a bug. And then it exhibits three typical types of motility. It's going to slowly move backwards or forwards. It's going to rotate around its central axis. And every now and then, it takes a little bend in the middle. And when you see those kinds of things together, you know that this is the organism T. pallidum that you're looking at. We also teach about Gram stain techniques. Using the Gram stain, you can evaluate male urethral specimens. And in addition to learning how to obtain the specimen, of course, you also want to know how to interpret it. I don't have my pointer. But on the right here, you can see the typical inflammatory cells that are called polymorphonuclear leukocytes, or PMNs. And on the left-hand side, inside some of those cells, you'll see the tiny little dot dots that are the gram-negative intracellular diplococci, or the organisms of gonorrhea. And so by this test, the Gram stain helps us to distinguish or differentiate between gonococcal and non-gonococcal urethritis. For your female patients, you know that the saline and KO8 wet melts are very, very important. And in these courses, you get some work with vaginal specimens, with the microscope, and you learn, not only how to collect the specimen, but how to use the light microscope, if that were to be new to you or to one of your staff members, and then how to identify those characteristic findings, including clue cells, various yeast forms, buds or pseudohyphae, and nodal trichomonads. This helps you, of course, to get an immediate diagnosis for your patient. Might be bacterial vaginosis, might be yeast vaginitis, might be trichomoniasis. And now let's look very briefly at rapid point-of-care tests for STDs and the kinds of courses that the training centers offer here. First of all, what are point-of-care tests? You probably all are familiar with these. Most of the tests that we order in the STD clinic, we send off to the lab, and the results come back to us on a delayed basis, right? It might take several days or a week to get the results of those back. In contrast, point-of-care tests are run by the clinician or other staff right there in your clinic. You don't even need to have a lab on site for many of these tests, so that you get the results immediately with that same clinic visit while you have your patient there with you. These tests are designed to be very easy to perform, virtually foolproof in the way that they are made. They usually require very simple equipment, if anything, outside the test kits that are provided by the makers, usually only a microscope or maybe a centrifuge or something like that. And they're often CLIA-waived. However, these point-of-care tests are generally not as sensitive and sometimes not as specific as the delayed test results. So why would a clinician ever want to use a less sensitive test? Well, these are not intended to replace the traditional kinds of STD tests that we've already talked about, wherever these are available, but you know that they're not always available. And if your patients are not likely to come back in a week for those test results that you send off to the lab, or if follow-up on the clinic's side is going to be very time-intensive or difficult, in fact, we can achieve higher levels of treatment in those kinds of cases. So that the places where these point-of-care tests, the rapid point-of-care tests, would probably be the most applicable are in settings like homeless clinics, emergency rooms, or correctional jail facilities, where patients are often released before you have a chance to get the results back from the lab. So when you take a point-of-care lab test from one of the PTCs, not only do you learn about the different testing technologies, how to use the kit, how to obtain the specimen for several of the infections that are listed on the left-hand side there, but you also learn about the lab issues related to using these tests. This is very important. A lot of clinicians really have kind of fuzzy information, a fuzzy idea about what CLIA is about. What do I need to do if I have a lab on site? So you would learn about those CLIA regulatory issues and also about maintaining quality assurance in the lab. And lastly, you're familiar with the rapid HIV tests. These are being used more and more. They have very high acceptability by both patients and clinicians. And in courses about rapid HIV tests, you would, again, learn not only how to perform the test using either oral fluid or finger stick samples, but also how to talk with your patient about the result after you have the result, which would fall to us if we are, in fact, the ones running the test, whether those results are positive or negative. So very briefly, that's some information about the lab courses that the NMPTCs offer. And I'm going to turn it over now to Terry, who will talk with us about interactive techniques, I believe, right? Terry.
Okay. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about some interactive approaches to learning. I'm going to be talking for myself, and I'm talking for Case Reitmeier. I am not as handsome as Case, and I'm a little shorter. We're not going to talk about how wide I am. Okay. When we talk about interactive approaches to learning, we also have to consider the population that we're serving. And one of my favorite clinician groups that I work with are the rural nurses, who very frequently operate under standing orders. So we have specific considerations that must be brought forward when we talk about these nurses. Oh, and I guess we should go forward with it. One is that they're very frequently operating under standing orders. And the scope of services that the nurses may be able to give in a different state differ across states. Are any rural nurses here? Okay, we have a few. So that there are some things that you can do and some things that you cannot do under standing orders. So when we bring our training to you, we have you come in for training, that's something that we have to bear in mind. We also have to understand that while in our STD intensives, we might have a wonderful comprehensive exam teaching component that the nurses will really appreciate taking part in, that's not something that they might not be able to do that when they get back to their home setting. So we need to emphasize specimen collection and pelvic exams and the kinds of things that they might be able to perform when they're in their own setting. We talked about the importance of specimen collection and the types of specimens that they collect. Very frequently, the partner services referrals, they may be referring to themselves because very often the community nurse or the rural health nurse wears the STD hat on Monday and the family planning hat on Tuesday and the well baby hat on Wednesday, and then on Thursday goes out to find the partners of the individuals that she saw or he saw during the day. So we want to bear that in mind as well. Very frequently, because they wear those different hats, getting away for training is very, very difficult. So we have been discovering that the groups that we have reached out to are very happy when we bring the training to them. It's probably less expensive because it's easier to travel one or two faculty to a particular site and stay there than bring four or five nurses from one site into a different location. We also have to be very careful about helping the nurses to develop some of the sexual history taking skills, especially in light of the fact that they cannot often do all of the exams. We want them to be good at observing symptoms. So when someone comes in, if they notice that there's a rash, if they notice that the sclera of the eye is yellow, that there are some things that they bear in mind when they're taking the sexual history that would guide their determination. We also want to help them to develop risk reduction counseling skills because very frequently, again, they're the point of care for many of the people in the communities that they serve. And so they'll be the folks that the young people are coming back to. And maybe some of us older folks, you know, will get an extra fillip and be sexually at risk again. I keep hoping. So now we're going to talk a little bit about doing a virtual clinic experience. There are some folks who have been working in Denver especially. They've been working at trying to do a virtual clinic interaction, and that's proving to be a little bit beyond our capabilities at the moment. But some of the things that we want to keep in mind when we talk about clinic experiences and learning how to make your clinic operate within the guidelines that are promulgated by the CDC are looking at your registration. You know, how do you handle that registration? Do you use a sequential numbering system? Do you have a specialty point that people are coded for certain services? Or because it's a small clinic, and everybody's called by name and there are many different services, then do you use the name to prevent any kind of breach of patient confidentiality? You want to pay attention to clinic flow. The ideal would be a three-stop clinic. In our clinic in Baltimore, I didn't introduce myself here. I'm from Baltimore, by the way. We have a five-stop clinic, and that's because we can't keep the exam rooms tied up. So we've managed to find a way to facilitate. But you want to have as little interaction from the point of view of footsteps going across the perimeter of your clinic, both from the point of view of your patient and from the clinician. So the patient gets to registration, then gets to an exam room, has specimens collected, and then may go back and sit in the waiting room while the specimens are read, or may stay in the exam room, and that the clinician has fewer steps to make as well. We talk about the importance of clinic staffing and all of the things that must be considered when we talk about that. For example, if you're working in a rural area, You may be able to operate under standing orders with a totally nurse-led clinic where the nurses are RNs without having a licensed clinician such as an NP or a PA or a physician on site. In our clinic, we're very fortunate that we have nurse practitioners, PAs, and physicians on site. But we're one of the model clinics for the country, and we follow the same guidelines as our sister clinics across the country. Laboratory capability. We have laboratory capability on site. We can do stat tests. In many instances, for example, in a rural clinic, you may not be able to do a stat test. You may have to send all of your laboratory out and then wait for the results to come back. So we have to understand about the capability and talk about what support systems are available. We need to talk about the importance of having your exam room properly. Staff is not the word I want. The lithotomy table, all your equipment needs to be there. And so we want to reinforce that information. Importance of having pH paper on site. That's one of my favorite necessities. To use your medical records for doing your morbidity reporting, your surveillance reporting, as well as your medical management of your patients, making sure that your medical records hold at the minimum the information that's necessary. Having a place where you can do counseling with a patient that would be available to offer patient confidentiality and some measure of security to that individual, that their information is not being listened to by everybody else in the clinic. And also reinforcing the importance of surveillance and data collection to inform your policy and program development. Now, one of the things that we frequently do is to discuss challenging cases. We did one year, Dr. Rampala, who's my medical director, did a telecast and worked with nurses, and their particular problem was vaginal complaints. And there were tremendous amounts of questions, and how do you manage this, how do you do that? And we have an example here of one of the things that they do in Denver, which is to bring together a small group of people. They're talking 15 to 20 participants. And they talk about different case studies, you know, the conundrum that faces a provider for non-gynecophagal urethritis or other urethral complaints, pelvic inflammatory disease, which is a very difficult condition to diagnose, talking about the problems that are associated with the genital herpes diagnosis, and syphilis, which has proven to be a very, very tricky disease and sort of laughs at us all the time. We try to keep it in small groups. We have the discussion is ongoing, and all of the training centers operate this way, giving the individuals who come to participate in the classes an opportunity to discuss ideas and discuss their problems that they see in their own settings. Oh, preceptor. I'm sorry. I thought. And then we talk about the importance, as Dr. Bachman talked about before, having the opportunity to do skills building, being monitored by and mentored by a preceptor so that you're in a safe place to test your skills, to try new skills, to try a new way of doing counseling, all of those kinds of things. The STD prevention training centers are divided. Their training is divided into two sections. One is the didactic section and the experiential section, and they're half and half. So it's a pretty unique kind of experience. And so we emphasize the importance of having a preceptor, getting hands-on experience with real patients in a real clinic setting, and getting the opportunity for the participant to demonstrate his or her skills and to practice those skills. Now we have Kathy Sue, who is our medical director for the RATEL Prevention Training Center.
Great, thank you very much, Terry. I just signed on about 7 months ago, and I now am the director for the Sylvie RATEL STD HIV Prevention Training Center. course, in honor of my predecessor. And today I have you for about the next 10 minutes to discuss interactive web-based courses on STD case management. I think there are many theoretical benefits to why internet-based CME might be attractive. For one, it might offer improved access, both across time and across place. Webcasts might be broadcasted only once, but for example, on the 31st, the Eastern Geographic Quadrant of the National Network of Prevention Training Centers is presenting a webcast entitled, "Which Tests Are Best? An Update on the Laboratory Diagnosis of Bacterial STDs." And it will be placed on the web in perpetuity, at least for the next year, so that even if you miss the 12:30 to 1:30 slot East Coast time, you might be able to see it at some other juncture. There is also the potential advantage that there is greater adaptability to learner style. I think we've all been in lecture settings where we've seen individuals who feel calm and collected enough to actually knit at the same time that they're learning. There are adult learners who learn better because in action they can think better if their fingers are busy. So there's greater adaptability to learner style if the learner is just using the internet or just using their home computer. There's the potential also to be more interactive, even more interactive than all of what the other medical directors and PTC coordinators have discussed. You could have realistic problem-solving settings, which we could do as cases, interactive cases on the web, or performing tasks in the context of clinical problems. You present the problem as a clinical problem, as if we were a clinician seeing the patient or in a virtual clinic. The web, of course, offers linkage to other resources. I don't know how many times a day or how many times an hour I would go visit the STD prevention and STD treatment guidelines when I'm in clinic seeing the adolescent patients that I see at BU. I often hit that website to just double check what a treatment regimen might be for herpes, recurrent herpes. So the advantage of an internet-based resource might be that you could hyperlink to other internet-based resources as well. And of course, let's say in the setting of a webcast, there might be additional advantages in terms of participation in social dialogue. In that webcast I just mentioned earlier, in the last 10 minutes, we'll have the opportunity for people nationwide to quiz the experts that may be also nationwide experts, nationally renowned, but aren't in your backyard normally, and you might have that opportunity to interact with them. These approaches are all in line with adult learning theories, so that's the theory, right? And here's the question. Is it actually borne out in evidence? What happens when you actually compare the instructional efficacy of internet-based CME with live interactive CME workshops? So this is just one paper out of many that have started to be written in the area of continuing medical education and continuing education units in general. And this was published by Fortas and his colleagues back in 2005, actually. And it was about cholesterol-based screening. Sorry, it wasn't STD-based. But the objective was to determine if internet-based CME produced changes comparable to changes via live small group interactive CME. And the participants were participating in a randomized controlled trial between 01 and 02, and they were 97 primary care physicians in Houston who were randomized to either an internet-based CME intervention completed over the 2 weeks at their leisure or single live small group interactive CME workshops, such as the one you're sitting in today. So both utilized multifaceted instructional approaches, and the content happened to be based upon the NIH National Cholesterol Education Program. The main outcome measures were dual, actually. They not only measured knowledge pre-intervention immediately post and 12 weeks later, but they also executed chart audits in the 5 months pre the intervention and in 5 months post-intervention. They examined cholesterol screening rates in these 97 practitioners and medication use rates that were subsequently prescribed. And the results were really that there were similar knowledge gains in the two groups. And the two groups started at baseline with very high cholesterol screening rates. They were already doing quite well. And non-significant post-intervention changes therefore occurred. But the internet-based intervention was associated with a significant increase in the percentage of high-risk patients treated with medications according to guidelines. And the authors chose to conclude that an appropriately designed, evidence-based online CME could produce objectively measurable changes in behavior as well as sustained gains in knowledge that are comparable to or superior to those realized from effective live activities. And I think that this is just one paper that proves that perhaps internet-based CME may live up to its promise in a lot of different ways. It just depends on how you execute it. So let me give you an example then of some of the many available internet-based CME activities that you could surf our NNPTC website for. So if you were to Google NNPTC, as I did up here in my Firefox browser one day, and I just did a screenshot of this because we don't have internet access in here today, otherwise I can show you a couple other things. If you went to the training resources page, this has just newly been updated to show that there are continuing education opportunities. And I'm just going to highlight one of the loveliest ones and one of the ones that we most recently posted, the hepatitis web study. So that's here. And you would discover if you clicked on that link, the hepatitis web study was produced by the Seattle STD HIV PTC. And they were pleased to present this, a free online education website for healthcare workers who provide clinical care to persons with viral hepatitis. And the service offers interactive case-based modules dealing with the diagnosis and management of hepatitis A, B, C, and other hepatitis viruses. And each module contains case studies, discussion points, references, etc., and you can get continuing education credit via this website as well. Let's take a closer look. Here's another screenshot. If you were to hit that link, you would have gone to the hepatitis web study. You might recognize a couple of the editors' names, just a few of them, somewhat famous. And if you were to choose that day because you had just seen a clinic patient who you were wondering whether or not they might have acute hepatitis B, for example, and you were to click on that, well, there you have it. A 27-year-old woman presents to urgent care clinic with new onset nausea and jaundice. Turns out she's a methamphetamine user. Laboratory studies do indicate she does have an AST level of 1900, an ALT level of 2000 or so. And the panel is ordered. And the question that's asked of you, the clinician, looking at this continuing education piece here is, which of the following serologic profiles would be most consistent with acute HBV infection? Would it be that it's a negative surface antigen, positive surface antibody, positive core antibody, negative E antigen, positive E antibody? I'm sorry, E antigen? Or would it be B? Or would it be C? And you'd be sitting in your office, hopefully going through this at your leisure, or perhaps getting interrupted three different times. And if you were to say B, as an accident, or by design, this answer is incorrect. Instant feedback, nothing like the digital age. Or if you were to have chosen C, it turns out surface antigen positivity, negative surface antibody, positive core, E antigen positive, and E antibody negative might be consistent with acute HBV infection. But it is also consistent, as the writers point out, with chronic HBV infection. Some of the other aspects to this particular website include a discussion section, and this is the one thing I really wish I had the internet for. You can actually examine, and we've all seen this before if you've ever looked at the serologic response to hepatitis B. It can be very confusing, right? The peak of the antigen predates several weeks before when the antibody is generated, the antibody specific to that antigen. And should you want to examine any one of these more closely, you could click on, say, the anti-HB surface antibody generation, which starts at about week 24 post-exposure, and it would be a lovely flash animated site. And we would be informed as clinicians that antibodies to hepatitis B surface antigen bind to the surface antigen present on the surface of the intact hepatitis B virions and HBV subviral lipoprotein particles, spheres, and filaments, giving us the details of the pathophysiology. And it's all animated. I've seeing that page in Harrison's internal medicine book is not the same as seeing the flash animated version of the site. It's pretty amazing. It makes it come alive a little bit more. So I think that just highlights one of many examples of the potential of the internet for internet-based CME. And I'll stop there and let Linda Cregan tell us where we're headed next. And I think we're doing great on time.
So thank you, Kathy. And whoops, let's see, now I am, here we go. So just to summarize what we've gone over in the didactic portion here, our experiential learning really gives a holistic approach for our patients with STDs, and these trainings can prepare you all for the various aspects of STD patient care, including taking a sexual history, physical exam skills, laboratory testing, diagnosis and treatment, partner management, and risk reduction counseling. So now that you've heard what we do, we want you to do what we do. And again, if you look in your packets at the agenda, on the second page of the agenda, you will see the list of skill building stations that are available. There are four. We would like you to choose two because you're going to spend a short time in one and then switch places and spend a short time in another. However, actually, these room numbers are correct. Folks who would like to do, are these correct? No, sorry, there's one change here. Folks who would like to do male and female pelvic exam skills will stay here in this room. And there we have two stations where you'll be working with a couple of preceptors in the room here. Folks who would like to do the syphilis case discussion with the RPR demonstration will be going to private dining room 6. This is on the in the opposite corner from here. All three of these breakout session rooms are in the opposite corner from where we are now. In fact, we'll sort of lead you over there as we're ready to go. You also have the choice to take a skills building course on effective risk reduction counseling skills or taking a sexual history. So take a minute to decide on two of those. Then we're going to break out. We're hoping this is going to work seamlessly. We will see. You'll have 5 minutes to get to where you're going. We'll spend 20, 25 minutes in that session. Then we'll switch, and you'll have 20 or 25 minutes in the second session. And we thank you very much for coming. We hope that you have enjoyed this and that you will enjoy even more doing what we do. So we'll see you in a few moments in your rooms.